Stars who are your company dance with you. Teach us the mystery of your dance. We may be in harmony with you. Learn to give away and renew. Oh, Moon Mother, your loving gaze falls softly on the sacred mountain. Oh, Moon Mother, your shining gaze falls softly on the sacred ocean.
Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I'm Karen Tate, and that little musical tease was Moon Mother by Lisa Veal, one of our local artists. Well, tonight's my great pleasure to have on the show Pamela Berger. She's a professor of art history and film at Boston College, and we have some very interesting topics for you tonight, reflecting her life's work and research. Pamela is also the author of the book, The Goddess Obscured, which allows us to segue into topics you might imagine, but inclusive of how the grain goddess became a saint. She's also the writer, producer, and or director of three films. One is Sorceress, about a medieval woman healer accused of sorcery. Then there's The Imported Bridegroom, about a young woman in turn-of-the-century Boston whose father is looking for a groom for his daughter. And Killian's Chronicle, a.k.a. The Magic Stone, which is the story of an Irish slave who escapes a Viking ship and is taken in by Native Americans 500 years before Columbus. I hope we also get to her work about women healers and healing sanctuaries and her articles such as The Bisexual Deity at Les Ballards and Gallo-Roman Spring Water Therapies. So we'll see how it goes. But before we start our interview tonight, I have just one quick announcement. I just would like you to save the date because Sacred Sundays have started at the Green Man in Hollywood, California. Our first service was last Sunday, and after being on hiatus for about 3 years. And from the feedback from those who came, I guess it really rocked. So save the dates. We'll be doing this every fourth Sunday of the month. It's a very eclectic service honoring the divine feminine and the sacred masculine. There's singing and sharing and wisdom telling, a great way to connect with the community and carve out some sacred time for yourself once a month. So check out my webpage at KarenTate.com. Go to the Sacred Sundays button and see what that's all about. But that brings tonight's announcements to a close, and I want to invite Pamela to join us here. Hi, Pamela.
Hi, Karen.
Well, thank you so much for being a guest on the show tonight. Maybe we should start with talking about your three films, which you said are all available on Amazon.
Yes. The first one is called Sorceress, and it's about an ancient cult dedicated to a saint who turned out to be a dog. But this saint provided cures when women prayed to this saint. The saint cured sick children. And there was a woman who led the cult of this saint, but who also knew the properties of healing of certain kinds of plants.
Now, is this fictional or is it based on...
No, actually, I found a Latin text from the 12th century, which told the outlines of this story. It was written by a monk named Etienne de Beaumont, and he wrote it after the events that I tell about in the film occurred. He was a young inquisitor, actually, a very deleterious kind of figure, and he came upon a village where he didn't realize at the time, but women were trying to heal their sick babies in a grove rite. And all of this was written. He wrote down all the parts of the grove rite, everything that the women did to try to heal the babies in the grove rite, including exposing the babies to potentially getting killed by a wolf. The ceremony was written down by Etienne much, much later in his life. The woman who led this ceremony, where partially they threw the baby between the branches of a tree and they put candles on either side of it and they exposed it to a wolf, and if the wolf didn't eat it, then the baby would be cured. It was a kind of a pagan ceremony. But my hypothesis was that because the woman was accused of taking the mothers and the babies to worship at an elder tree, Therefore, she was probably using the elements of the elder tree in her healing at the same time as going through all the ancient ritual practices. I found out that the elder tree actually has, when picked at the proper time and prepared in the proper way, it has certain kinds of elements, antibiotic elements, and it also has elements that would be homeopathic and be used in a homeopathic context today in France. So
in other words, when this person was writing what he observed, he left that part out, or somehow he didn't?
No, in fact, he left all that in, and it's therefore it's a very precious relic of what peasants were thinking and doing, because peasants, of course, in the 13th century couldn't write. They couldn't tell us. They couldn't leave any record of what they did and what they thought and what they dreamed and what they believed. But a priest, of course, did know how to write. And Étienne de Bourbon wrote at the end of his life, he wrote his life, basically, in a certain structure. And in those days, they used to write in a sort of scholastic structure with like an outline with parts and parts within parts and parts within parts. And he wrote this under a section of this biography, under a section about pride. And he wrote about it because he discovered that they were actually worshiping not a saint, but that the saint that they called to in this rite was a dog.
Now, why was that? I mean, how does the dog fit into the picture?
I know that deep under the stratum of Christian saints is another stratum of pre-Christian Celtic gods, because the Celts, in the form of the Gauls and in other forms, were those people who lived to the north of the Romans from really the 800s BCE right up through, you know, the 4th to 6th century, when they were totally assimilated into Latin-speaking, well, not totally assimilated, but most more likely than not assimilated into the Latin and then eventually the Provençal culture and language. But the people who were the Celts lived there with their own language and their own art motifs for all of those, for that, you know, at least a millennium and a half. They ended up surviving only in Ireland, and it's in Ireland that you continue to have those motifs, those sort of magical signs in the great Irish works of art. But those Celts worshipped animals. And when the Romans came in and conquered them, when Caesar and conquered the Celts, who were the Gauls, those animals no longer appeared powerful to the Celts. So what they did was they merged the anthropomorphic, that is to say the human-looking gods, Zeus and Apollo and Mercury, etc., with the animal gods that they had worshipped before. So we see a human-looking god with antlers and hoofs. You see that kind of thing. They merge them together.
Right.
So those gods continue in the form. And so a dog also was in those pre-Christian Celtic times a god, a protector.
Well, and you see that with the animal-headed Egyptian deities.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
You know, I was in the Vatican Museum in the Egyptian-Roman section, and there they had a Roman Anubis, and here he was in a toga, but he had the jackal head.
Exactly, exactly. And you see that in, I have some examples of a dog-headed Saint Christopher, who was a saint particularly venerated in the Greek church, but also in the Latin church, and he is shown with a dog's head. So you still even get it in icons from much, much later.
Oh, that's very interesting. I didn't know the Celts did that too.
The Celts did worship deities that were animal-like. Yes, they did. We have many examples. We have the boar god, who was one of their major gods, and you have statues that have both a boar on it as well as a human torso with a head.
Very cool. So, but getting back to the movie a bit, your film, The Sorceress, sort of follows this idea of the priest comes upon the woman healer, and you want to sort of tell a little bit about how the film goes?
Yeah, well, I followed the text fairly closely, but of course, in order to make a movie, you have to write something that has a plot in it and that has that fills out characters. So I made the woman healer based on Well, this woman healer passed her tradition down right up until the 20th century. There was always a woman healer in this region. And so I envisioned that each woman healer would have had to pass down her knowledge of plants and healing methods and the preparation of plants to another woman. And most often, those women were, in one way or another, an outsider. That is to say, they weren't a woman who married normally and had, babies and had a family. They were somehow ostracized from society. And I took that idea and made this woman healer one of those ostracized people, and gave her the attributes of what scholars had found was the last woman healer, a woman named Françoise Gadin, who died in the 1930s and whose grave was bulldozed in the 1970s, who was the last surviving woman healer in this particular area of southeast France. So I gave my character these attributes, and in Sorceress, she has those attributes. She was a victim of sexual violence, something in the Middle Ages that we call the first knight rite, where the lord could take the virgin bride of a young, of a young peasant boy, mm-hmm. and take her and rape her. And in this case, I made a drama out of that and what happened there. And then when the baby and the lord ended up killing the boy, the husband, the boy bridegroom, because the bridegroom attacked the lord and his henchmen killed the bridegroom. And so this woman then had to flee with her mother and went far distant and found an old woods woman who was a healer. And the old woods woman taught her the healing ways. And
all of this is in The Sorceress.
Yeah, all of this is part of The Sorceress. It's all part of that.
Sounds really interesting. I read the brief synopsis, and uh-huh. that part, I don't recall that part being in there, but it reminds me of an old movie I saw a long time ago with mm-hmm. Charlton Heston called The Warlord, and it talked about that privilege of the of the king, or whatever you call it, the lord of the area, to take the woman before the groom had a chance.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So they call it
the droit de cuissage in French, and there's some evidence that it existed in the late Middle Ages. We don't have a lot of written evidence for this, and some scholars have debunked the idea, but there is some late medieval evidence that it did exist, and I don't doubt that it did exist, because when I did my research for my book and just my general research, one finds that in general, women, as in some places today, are victimized by violation, and it's
absolutely
very sad.
Well, and also too, she sounds like she would be the perfect woman that would be the target of the Inquisition.
You're right. Yes, she was, because he was looking for her.
But that's not her fate in your movie.
Well, I don't want to give away the ending, but Étienne de Bourbon, who was the priest, who was the inquisitor, in his biography, autobiography, he tells about participating in trials where women were put to death for being witches or sorceresses. But he doesn't talk about one after the time that he visited this particular village. And so my hypothesis is that something happened to him then in that village that made him change. And so that's what the drama's about.
Okay. And that can be found on Netflix, and it's called
Not Netflix. Amazon. And actually, when we shot the film, we shot it in both French and in English. That is to say, I wrote the script in English. It was translated into French, and we did takes. We do 4 or 5 takes in French, and then we do 3 or 4 takes in English. And when we edited the film, you're out there in Hollywood, so you have a lot of listeners probably who know about this. But when we edited the film, the close-ups and the medium shots, we used the English language takes for the English language version, and the French takes for the French version, and the rest of the films, the long pans and the landscapes, etc., the other shots, action shots or whatever, those we just those are the same in both of those. So basically,
yeah, those are interchangeable.
Yeah, those are interchangeable.
Makes perfect sense. Well, there's so much I want to ask you, including how did you ever get financing? But let's leave that for if we have time. So then you're
well, that's an easy answer. I can just tell you right off the bat.
Okay, go ahead.
Financing from the National Endowment for the Humanities, because when I wrote the script, a wonderful officer at the National Endowment for the Humanities said to me, well, she asked me the same question you did. What if this is true and what if this is fiction? And so what I did was I footnoted the script. So everything that was true and that depended upon the Latin text that I was going out of or other medieval scholarship, I footnoted that. And when I sent in my footnoted script to prove the validity of what I was basing my drama on, they gave, 85% or 90% of the money. No, not 85% or 90%. No, about 60% of the money. And then I got a French co-producer and a Swiss co-producer, and that's how the film was made. And the director is Suzanne Schiffman.
Wow. Well, and then the other two films, the same situation?
The money that came in from Sorceress, when I asked the National Endowment, well, what am I supposed to do with this money? They said, well, they hadn't really had money coming back in yet, and coming in other projects. They said, you basically can use it for your future work. So I made another film. And then when that film brought in revenue, I made a third film. So that's how we did it.
Okay. Well, now the other one that I read a bit on was Killian's Chronicle, a.k.a. The Magic Stone.
Yeah.
And I have to ask you, in all sincerity, I still think the majority of people think Columbus discovered America. I don't think they give the fact that the Vikings were here earlier credit. Do you think, feel free to tell me if I'm wrong. It's okay. I like to learn, and that's part of my pleasure of doing this show. Do you think Columbus gets the credit because Columbus was Christian and the Vikings were just these heathen pagans? Is it something to do with that, you think?
I don't really think so. I think that, and I haven't really researched this, but when I've looked at this a little bit, the texts are ample about Columbus. We know all about him and was born and what he... Fernand Isabel, we know a lot of it because it all happened, in the 15th century, late 15th century. Whereas I had to really scrounge to get the texts about the Vikings. And when you look at those texts, the Viking sagas, which are the basic texts of the Viking exploration, they're very vague. They talk about finding rivers full of salmon, and they talk about seeing volcanoes, and they talk about seeing what seems to me sounds like the Florida Keys, but I'm sure they didn't get that far down. But, kinds of grapes and things. And so we didn't realize until archaeologists discovered the Viking settlement in Newfoundland at Lonsley Meadows, we didn't realize that the Vikings had actually come to these shores. You couldn't really prove it based on the Icelandic sagas and their descriptions of the Viking voyages, you see.
Okay,
so
all right.
That's what I think it was. I think but now I often ask youngsters, wherever I go in the country, I ask youngsters who are third, fourth, fifth grade, I say, what are you learning about the Vikings? And they're learning now, that the Vikings...
Oh, that's good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
All right, so Killian's Chronicle, the a.k.a. The Magic Stone, talk a little bit about that, because I found that really interesting as well.
That's based on, as I said, this mythology that is grounded in the Icelandic sagas. It's a text that exists now from the 1200s, but it's based on something that was a couple of hundred years earlier. And it tells the story, amongst other things, of several voyages that Vikings made over to we now know these shores. On one of those voyages, they came upon what they thought of as other creatures, and they immediately had a hostile reaction to them and tried to kill them.
Now we're talking the Native Americans, indigenous
they
people.
Tried to kill, and they would have been people who would have been Passamaquoddy, Mi'kmaq, Maliseet people, that is to say, part of the Algonquin tribes of northeastern America and into Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, those people there. Now the progeny of those people are still, of course, around, and there are still people up in Maine who speak the ancient language, the Algonquin language of Passamaquoddy. And they have a whole culture, of course, and they have a whole mythology. So I merged the Native American mythology with the Viking mythology. And whereas the Western European, you know, the Vikings and Western Europeans in general had strange ideas about, not strange, I mean the way we would think of people on other planets, you know, they thought of people who lived in various other parts of the world as looking, as having like one leg or maybe an eye in the middle of their belly or maybe having a dog's head or different kinds of shapes.
So you're saying they didn't see them as they really were.
They didn't see them as they really were, but people usually don't. But when they saw, when they no doubt saw Native Americans running across snow with an animal skin wrapped around their middle, going all the way down to the snow, they saw that as one sort of trunk-like foot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, and you know, and so that accorded with what they thought of these strange peoples who have maybe like one trunk-like foot, you know, or long black hair such as the Vikings had never seen because they were all fair-skinned and fair-haired. And they saw them as animal-like in some ways. So I merged these impressions that we have recorded on the Western European side with the way the Native American mythology viewed the universe and viewed the people who would come, who might come from some other place. I merged that together and came up with the story. Now, in one of those Viking tales, there were two Irish slaves on board one of the ships, a man and a woman. And I made the whole story through the eyes of one of those Irish slaves who escapes from the Viking ship and eventually comes in contact with Native Americans and is cared for by them. You know, it surprises people that there was such a thing as Irish slaves in the year 1000.
Mm-hmm.
But,
mm-hmm.
of course, there was slavery all over the place. In Rome. Rome would take slaves that they would capture in Greece and bring them over to someplace in North Africa, and they would take slaves from Gaul and maybe bring them to Egypt, and I mean, so that they couldn't escape because they wouldn't know the language or the customs or whatever, and they would look different, you know, so they'd be marked, you know.
So it was like wearing an orange jumpsuit.
Yeah, right. St. Patrick was a slave. The famous St. Patrick of Ireland, you know, he was taken as a slave, learned the Celtic, you know, the Irish tongue, and then went back to England and then came back as an adult and converted the Irish. But there were Welsh slaves, Irish slaves, English slaves, and the Vikings were amongst those who both took slaves and were taken as slaves. The word slave actually comes from, the word Slav comes from the word slave, because some of the peoples who were taken from Russia down those big, you know, Russian rivers that the Vikings went down, those people were used as slaves also. So we have slaves who were yellow-haired slaves and black-haired slaves and brown-haired slaves and all kinds
of
skin-colored
slaves. Yeah, no one was
safe. No one was safe.
You were a fount of information. So Pamela, the magic stone, what is the significance of that?
Well, one of the things, you see, I had to invent a story. So I found out that the Vikings made use of various ways that they could figure out how to navigate. One way they navigated is they stayed close to shore and watched the flight of birds. So they know birds were heading toward land, so they knew that land was that way. Or they, of course, watched the sky to see, because they could read the stars and the positions of the stars, and they would know how far close or how far they were south, depending upon the stars. But when there were no stars and when it was a cloudy day, how did they figure out where they were? Well, there is one mineral called cordierite, which refracts the sun. So if you put it up to the cloudy sky and you don't know where the sun is, this cordierite will glint when you put it in front of that clouded area where the sun is behind on a completely overcast day. And so that stone is what helps them navigate to get back home, you see, to figure out where the sun is and therefore which direction they should go in. So that stone was a precious thing for Vikings, and they could get, and they they needed it. And this, the Irish slave, as he's escaping from the Viking ship, he takes that precious magic stone with him so they can't get back home. So, and then they have to find him. So that's part of the drama of the movie.
Right, right, right. Okay, and then your third, the imported bridegroom, a
uh-huh.
young woman, turn of the century Boston. Her father is trying to find her a husband.
Yeah, and he goes back to the old country and comes back with a husband who is completely inappropriate. She's a sophisticated young woman, and he comes from a village in what's called the Jewish shtetl. And this boy is brought home to Boston, in this case. I made it in Boston. And she takes one look at him, and she's appalled. The story is based on one of the same title by Abraham Kahan, who wrote it at the turn of the 20th century. And it was just a wonderful story. It was a light story, and I had fun making that movie. It doesn't have the resonance for your audience that it might have. But.
Well, you know, I just have to say I really am looking forward to looking for these on Amazon because mm-hmm. I really like it when you mm-hmm. get a film and the people have done their homework and things mm-hmm. are accurate and really mm-hmm. based on mythology and really based on the time. You know, mm-hmm. I appreciate, you know, when that sort of effort has been put into telling the story.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I encourage my listeners to, you know, to look for those as well. So, mm-hmm. so Pamela, all right, so going back to Sorcerer, you know, that was about
sorceress. Yes, and be careful. I should think you should tell your listeners also that there's another Sorceress out there, which is a kind of a pornographic movie, and I don't want them to get it mixed up with mine. So they should look for the Sorceress that has a picture of a woman healer looking kind of person with her hair covered and that it's associated with my name, Pamela Berger, and that there's a French version because we shot it in French and it has English subtitles, and there's an English language version so they can get either version on Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you gave us that heads up.
Uh-huh.
so now since you know, your main character in that movie was a woman healer, is that how you started getting interested in the women healers and the healing sanctuaries? I mean, you know, how did that all evolve?
Well, I guess I have to tell you that I forgot to put this to talk to you about this, but I'm one of the founding members of Our Bodies Ourselves, which is a book by and for women.
Oh, and I remember that book, yeah.
You remember that book, yeah.
I do.
At any rate, one of the chapters I worked on that in that book, Our Bodies Ourselves, was healing, a chapter specifically on healing, all kinds of sort of non-medical healing. At that time in the 80s when I was working on that chapter, the healing that we looked at were, you know, we looked at herbal medicines, we looked at acupuncture, we looked at massage and chiropractic and things that in that time, you know, were
mm-hmm.
very suspect. Now, of course, people, you know, it's part of common medicine, and even the health plans usually cover those kinds of things. But at that time, it was a great risk, and many of those healing techniques were practiced at that time by women, and that was one of the things that got me interested in it. And as I was looking for illustrations for that chapter, as an art historian, I naturally looked to the art historical representations of the woman priestess Hygieia, because there was this
mm-hmm.
ancient goddess, I'm sure your audience knows, you know, Asclepius,
mm-hmm.
but Hygieia was his companion, sort of sister or whatever. And so I just started getting interested in Hygieia and ancient healing sanctuaries in Greece and what that healing was like.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fascinating to me because it connected to dreams, and I'm very interested in dream
mm-hmm.
life.
The dream incubation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so in those healing sanctuaries, first of all, you could not be ill when you went in. You couldn't be dying when you went in. You could be ill but not dying. And you couldn't have sort of impurities. I mean, you couldn't have sort of women's, you know, menstrual flow or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You had to be.
And they even considered some women who had just given birth impure, too,
I think.
Because the Island of Delos. So, I mean, I used to lead sacred tours, and I've
mm-hmm.
written a book myself on sacred places of goddess around the
mm-hmm.
world. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I've come in contact with a lot of this stuff. And it's
mm-hmm.
it is pretty common that in some of these places, you know, women's blood, you know, was taboo even in the pagan world. And I think we think of it in patriarchal Christian terms, but it was happening then as well.
Yes, absolutely, very much so. Women, you know, menstruating women were verboten in many places. But you could come in for various other things like tumors or problems with your eyes or problems, you know, arthritic problems. And in these healing sanctuaries, well, if you've written about them, you know. But I mean, there's one in Corinth, you know. There's one at the source of the Seine River. There's one in Auvergne. And in these healing sanctuaries, they often had. They would show you the well body part. Say you had a breast tumor, okay? They would show you the healed breast and the breast with the tumor. And they would those images would either be made out of terracotta or out of wood. And they would hang those sick and healed body parts from somewhere in, they'd hang them on the walls or they'd hang them at the portal, et cetera. We have a Greek vase that actually shows those healing sanctuaries and what.
No, is that what they call ex voto? Is that the word for that?
Yes, you can call that.
Okay.
There's ex votos. And when people went to those healing sanctuaries, they were to meditate on the well part, the healed arm or breast or leg or whatever it was, or eyes. And as they meditated, they were taken into a room. They called it the abaton, but it's just really the sleeping room. And they would lie down on a mat, and they would sleep. Probably it was like a reverie, a dream, a meditation sleep. But they would dream, and they would sort of. Sometimes you can, if you think about things before you go to bed, you can get yourself to dream it, like flying or something like that. The priestesses and the priests would come in with serpents around their arms, and they would go from bed to bed, from bed to bed, and they would sometimes, and they sometimes have a dog with them, and the dog would lick the person's wound, and somehow the snake would be part of the healing ritual. In that, we know that if you know, snakes move out of their skin. Every year,
so transformation.
Pardon me.
I'm sorry. Were they supposed to get the idea of transformation? They were transforming their body from unhealed to healed, or
exactly symbolically, it's a rebirth because the snake goes out of the old and comes into and grows a new skin. But they actually had a physiological effect when the snake skin was prepared in a particular way. Pliny talks about this, prepared in a certain way. That they could that would become a medication. So there was the psychological and the symbolic, and then the physiological. Healing to the snake. So the snake was part of that ritual, and obviously because there were so many of them and because they lasted for so long, they had an effect. Now you and I can say, well, that was a placebo effect; it didn't have any effect. But the snake skin's elements could have had some healing effect. I don't know if scientists have looked at that, but they, you know, maybe they have. They have since looked at the healing effects of Sambucus, that elder tree that I talked about in Sorceress. They made a tea out of that, and they haven't looked at it enough to my mind. But and I did that. I did that film, by the way, before the yew tree became known as something you could extract a cure for cancer from. This was way before they understood that the property in the yew tree was something that tamoxifen, you know, could result from. At any rate, so the healing sanctuaries worked, and so there's something very important. I mean, there is that psychological element to healing, which we all, you know about. And so perhaps that relaxation that ensued after people believed that they were going to be healed actually did help the blood flow more freely and actually did help them to heal.
Well, you know, it makes me think about those commercials on television about one of these cancer clinics that treats the whole body. You know, they treat you spiritually, they treat you physically. You know, it's sort of like they treat the whole person. They don't just go cut out the cancer, kind of a thing. You know,
right? Well, you know, people have to have hope. You know, we can't. I mean, I really hate this thing of people talking about cancer, that people win the fight or lose the fight with cancer. I hate that idea because it's not a winning and a losing. You know, this is what happens in the body, and you know, it doesn't. It has this connotation that somehow you failed if you lost. And
right.
It's just not fair and not true also.
Well, and there's stuff to be said about the power of the mind, you know, mind over matter. I mean, we know, you know, studies have shown when people are prayed over, you know, that focused intention, you know, that sometimes that helps people heal faster, you know.
Well, I think we have to, sometimes does, but sometimes it doesn't, and those people are no less brave than the next guy who does heal, you know.
Right, right.
It's just one of those things, and you can't blame the patient for not healing. And even though relaxation, we know with Raynaud's disease, for instance, they've done work here in Boston with the disease where your circulation is such that your fingertips remain cold. One of these doctors, Benson, has actually had as a machine where you can hold onto something or other and look at a dial and concentrate and make that dial go up. You have to concentrate on making the dial go up, and in fact, the warmth of your fingers, your fingers getting warmer, does make the dial go up. So there is some power in the mind that
right.
can sometimes do that in that instance, and in relaxation. You know, you have a physiological effect of learning how to relax your muscles and calm your blood pressure down.
Right, right. Well, and if, you know, it's been a long time since I wrote my book, but if memory serves, you know, from, you know, going on, you know, tours to, like, you know, places of Asclepius and Hygieia and things like that, I mean, you know, there was a lot of alternative medicine happening in these sanctuaries. I mean, there were affirmations, there was hypnosis, there
yes.
was dream incubations. I mean, you know, I guess things that here in California we don't blink an eye about, but like you said, you know, maybe a couple decades ago, you know, people didn't even know these sorts of treatments existed, but they were using
right.
these in these ancient sanctuaries.
Right, right.
Well, what do you think is the biggest misconception, maybe, about the healing sanctuaries? Does something come to mind?
I don't think that many people know about the healing sanctuaries in the ancient world. I don't think that.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, from the perspective of our listeners, I know I've had a wonderful scholar on the show by the name of David Hillman, and he actually, you know, for the last 30 years has translated his own Greek, and he came on the show and just wowed everybody because he was talking about how powerful the women in ancient Greece really were because of their pharmacological abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm wondering, you know, in these ancient sanctuaries, were they primarily run by men and women, or did
well,
one gender?
Yeah, the people who crafted the objects were probably men, but we don't have, I don't know what Hillman says, but we don't, to my knowledge, we don't have texts about it. I mean, when we look at the evidence on the Greek vases, for instance, most of the artists who are depicted on Greek vases are men. But there is one Greek vase I know of where the artist is a woman. So it wasn't impossible for women to be crafting these objects. Now, in terms of the priests and priestesses, we know there were ancient priestesses in the ancient world. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Right through the 5th century, 4th, 5th century, there absolutely were priestesses. And these goddesses, this is something I talk about in my book, these goddesses who they existed in people's minds, imaginations, and even in people's artwork, right up through, by artwork I mean sort of crude statuary, right up through the 600s, 700s, people didn't want to let these women, powerful women goddesses, and in some cases priestesses, go because it's fixed in their mind that these are the figures who have the power. Now, we know that, you know, in the ancient world, the woman, because she has the power to give birth, was often made analogous to the earth itself, because in some mysterious way, the plant, the seed is planted in the earth, and somehow, magically, you know, it quickens, and it sprouts, and then it grows, and it makes us food, and we can live and survive because of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
So this analogy between the woman's body, which creates life, and the earth, which creates life, that was a common analogy. And therefore, those goddesses who were in charge of kind of overseeing the fertility of the earth were very tough to let go of in the early Christian period. But there were no, you know, there wasn't really a strong Christian female presence in, it was the Trinity, you know, God the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit certainly was not conceived of as a female presence at that time, although now it's being resurrected as a possible
female presence. Yeah, unless you look at the Sophia connections. So we talked about the people who made the ex votos, but what about the people who were actually dishing out the pharmacology, the herbs, you know?
Well, as I say, we have evidence of priestesses as well with their snakes around their arms, you know, and so there probably were priests as well as priestesses there.
Yeah.
I don't doubt that.
All right. Well, let's talk. You know, maybe this is a good segue to the. I didn't get a chance to read your article, but it was called "The Bisexual Deity at Les Boulards and the Gallo-Romans." And the Gallo-Roman Spring Water Therapy.
Yeah, this
does
is
that sort of fit into the healing theme.
It's the same kind of thing as you saw with the healing sanctuaries that you must have gone to in Greece. In France, there are some. Also, one is in Auvergne, one is at the source of the rivers of the Seine River, the river that ultimately goes by Paris, and one is at Les Boulards, which is right in the middle of the Nuit Saint-Georges area where they make the Grand Cru, the great French wines there. And at that sanctuary is primarily a healing sanctuary in the Gallo-Roman world, the first and second centuries, the Common Era. And that was primarily devoted to eye injuries, but also there are some other kinds of tumors that are shown on breasts and things like that. So yes, that's another place where we had crafted what you call ex votos that aided people in their meditative healing practices to look at the healed and at the sick, to see the sick going from the sick to the healed, from the tumor to the well.
So now the Gallo-Roman spring water thing, does that mean that they thought when they would sort of take the cure in the waters, was that about?
As it happened, there at Les Boulards and at other places around about, there are these springs. Now, springs are thought of as also as magical. I mean, the earth suddenly opens up and water comes out. I mean, isn't that amazing? And it's not the usual fresh water of rivers. Very often it's got helium in it or it's got salt, like Saratoga Springs, right? We now know slightly radioactive, but it has some salt, you know, if you ever tasted that up there, it tastes different. It has sulfur in it or salts in it of some kind.
Yeah, like Bath in England.
Exactly.
Not a very good taste, but it's supposed to really purify you.
Right, because it's in there with those rocks that have, you know, that are seeping salt out of it. But that difference in that kind of water was perceived as therapeutic, and maybe just like it is in Saratoga and in Bath in England. And so this healing sanctuary at Les Boulards was right near one of those helium springs. And it's strange when you look at it because like helium bubbles come up out of it, you know, big, big bubbles of helium. And if you get close to the water, you can sort of smell the helium. It's weird. So, yes, I think, and in general, there's a magical connotation to springs because they come out of the Earth Mother's body, if you will. People go there to springs. For instance, in France, they have their wedding pictures taken at a spring. Everyone goes from the church to a spring or to a water source like that.
Makes me think of Bridget and all her healing wells.
Yeah, exactly. Bridget's wells.
Yeah.
And
right,
the trees
right.
next to them, the bitty trees, and I have friends who bring back pictures all the time of those trees next to the Bridget wells, and people putting
Clutie trees. Clutie trees. It's one word for them, I believe. You know, you tie your prayer onto the tree, and you know, it's like giving your prayer to the goddess. You know?
Exactly. You know, I saw this also in a film. Oh, actually, a beautiful film. The Color of Paradise, an Iranian film, where in Iran, present-day Iran, the grandmother takes a blind boy to a spring, the same kind of thing, and people are going there. It's on a mountain, and people go there, and she washes his face with the water of the spring, and it's the same kind of thing. They light candles, and
mm-hmm.
it's a ritual practice. Well, Iran, of course, is Persia, and that's part of the Indo-European rather than Semitic context, and it's, you know, the sources of that culture are Indo-European, like the Western European sources of culture.
So, I was thinking about the healing sites as well. So, you know, we're thinking about Bridget and her waters there, also
mm-hmm.
Lourdes.
I know
there are places where apparitions of the Our Lady, whoever that's
mm-hmm.
supposed to be, I guess it's in
mm-hmm.
the eye of the beholder,
mm-hmm.
you know, appeared, like in Knock, Ireland, was another
mm-hmm.
place where you can go there and get the sacred water, or
mm-hmm.
Even up in Jerusalem, you get the sacred water at the House of Mary. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, water, you know, water's always, I think, had this very magical property. And you say, his name's escaping me right now. I want to say it's Yamamoto, but the guy who wrote the book on water, where if you pray over water, it actually changes the molecular structure, you know. But anyway, I digress. I apologize.
No, that's okay. No, water is, you're right. I mean, water, not only the springs that come up, but, of course, rainwater and all kinds of water. You're right.
Le Bollard, you say it so much more beautiful than I can. I don't have that roll of the tongue. But you talk about the bisexual deity there. What was that about?
Well, there is a god, an ancient mother goddess. One of them was named Cybele or Cybele.
Oh, yeah.
And she originates in Anatolia. And there
mm-hmm.
are different stories about her, several
mm-hmm.
different kinds of stories. But in one of the stories, she goes to a shepherd, Attis, and she wants to make love to him, and he spurns her, and so she asks Zeus to kill him. And then she's sad when Zeus kills him, and she asks Zeus to resurrect him again. And so in one phase of the story, you know, he does resurrect him in the spring, so it becomes a vegetation deity, you know, like resurrecting in the spring. But in another phase in the story, the way Zeus had killed him was through castration and bleeding to death. But Zeus allows him to continue to heal and then to continue to be moving his little finger. So he heals him, basically. So that image of Cybele appears in a particular relief in the Gallo-Roman sanctuary at Les Bollards. Cybele with her crown, and in that version where Attis gets healed and is able to move his little finger continuously and not be completely dead, she is a bisexual deity. She has both breasts and a penis.
Oh.
That's a special version of that Cybele as she becomes a healing goddess.
Well, I hadn't heard that. That's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
in Les Bollards, there's actually this is actually a place I can put on my itinerary for a sacred site.
There's a little museum there, actually.
Okay. Okay.
It's Les Bollards. It's in Neuilly Saint Georges, which you can definitely find on a map. It's in the middle of the wine. You know, the wine Neuilly Saint Georges. That's made right there, so it's definitely
on all those maps. So is it like a day trip out of Paris, or?
It's a long day trip. It's maybe 2 hours down from Neuilly Saint-Georges. But you wouldn't go. You'd go for a whole. You'd go to Neuilly Saint-Georges. You'd go to Beaune also, and you'd go to a whole Burgundy wine region there.
Okay. Well, and I'm thinking about Cybele and Attis. I mean, well, you know, they had those ecstatic rites.
We say Cybele or Cybele. How do you
say it? It's so many different ways. I
uh-huh.
think, you know, I'm not sure there is an exact way. Cybele,
uh-huh.
Cybele, Cybele.
I see.
Yeah,
uh-huh. Okay.
But it's all the same person. But I'm thinking, you know, they had those ecstatic rites in Rome where the male priests would sever their penis.
Yeah,
and you know, and then it sort of you know, turn them you know, sort of in a sense as a like, I don't know if transgender is the right word. That's
no,
why
no,
I was
no. not
you
transgender.
Know.
They would be priests. They would be castrated, and they would be priests. That was both to Diana. I've read it more, you know, to Diana. I think in the Fraser book, he starts out his book like that, but. But yes, they would castrate themselves under a tree, and those who didn't bleed to death would become priests, and that would be a very coveted position to be.
And what was their purpose behind that? Were they trying to be more feminine, less masculine, or?
No, I don't. Well, I don't know if she'd be more feminine, but I think, well, you would certainly lose your testosterone, but you would be more pure because you wouldn't engage in the physical act of sex. You would be, you know, you would rise above that. Now, we don't think of the ancient world as decrying sex, but obviously there was a level of purification in this particular cult that demanded complete sexual abstinence in order to serve the goddess.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, goddess, you know, she's a virgin goddess, Diana.
Yeah.
Artemis, Diana's a virgin, so that's appropriate for her priests.
Okay. In some of the materials you sent me, you said you wanted to talk about the changeling concept and the charity image. Where does that fit into what we've been talking about?
Well, the changeling in sorceress.
Mm-hmm.
This is a psychological thing. When sometimes, you know, when you have a sick baby, you do whatever you can to heal the baby. You'll have to take it to the doctor, you'll take it to the hospital, you'll take it to the church, but you'll take it to the whatever you can do for that baby.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow, in the Middle Ages, when you had taken it to the church, and you had taken it to the woman healer, and still the baby was hot and had a fever and was coughing or whatever, you get in, there is a concept that this wasn't really your baby. The baby belonged to the elves of the forests. So you would take it in this particular case. We have this whole thing described in this text, which I had as I was reading. You take the baby to the woods, and there you would get your real baby back. You would go there, and you would put your baby down on some leaves, and you would put candles on either side. You would expose it to the wolves, and you would back off behind a tree, and you would chant, and at a certain point, you would go back, and if the baby was cool, it was your real baby. If the baby was still hot, they didn't change your real baby back. This baby does not belong to you then, and it can be taken away. You see, I mean, babies mostly died. I mean, as we know, the population didn't grow until, you know, after the 14th century, the population started to grow a bit, but most of our great-grandparents, they would have five or six babies at least, and then maybe two or three would survive. But it was so precarious that psychologically the parents, particularly the mother, didn't, you know, want to figure out a way that it really wasn't her fault if the baby didn't survive. It wasn't really hers, it gave it to somebody else's. I mean, Jews have a ritual of the idea that the first baby that's born, if it's a male, it doesn't belong to the family. It belongs to God. If it survives 30 days, then they buy it back from God in exchange for two turtle doves or two shekels or whatever.
They give that to the temple.
This is the ancient... Jesus had one of these rituals. He was brought to the temple, and he was bought back from God because he was the first baby to open the womb. But that's a common ritual today amongst religious Jews. They would buy the baby back. So it's a psychological thing that if it dies in the first 30 days, it was not your fault, it belongs to God, you didn't do anything wrong, and it saved a lot of people a lot of anguish. I mean, not that you wouldn't feel terrible anguish, but it wouldn't be the same kind of guilt that you might feel if the baby belong to you. So it's called the buying back ceremony. The changeling idea in the Middle Ages is a manifestation of the same thing in the Christian context.
So the baby changes. If the baby goes from sick to cool, it's changed out there in nature,
to
the fairies or whatever.
Exactly, the fauns, they call them. Exactly, the right one has been brought back.
Okay, and if that happened, was that the charity of nature?
That's a separate concept. A charity is a separate concept, but it's a concept. I evoked, there's a subplot in Sorceress, according to which a woman's husband is put for having thwarted and having thwarted the knight of the region, the lord of the region,
mm-hmm.
Her husband is put into the tower to starve to death.
Okay.
So she wants to figure out a way to help him escape. She's allowed to visit him, but with nothing in her hands. So she figures out a way to weave hemp into her skirt so that nobody can see it. She goes up into the tower, and he's starving. He's not given any food or any water. She nurses him for those 30 days.
From her breast?
From her breast. Now, and eventually, of course, he's able to escape because the hemp from her skirt, he pulls out the little bit of hemp every day, and he makes a rope, and he's able to escape. But the image of the woman, surreptitiously making him survive through her nursing him, this is an image that's the image of charity, of caritas, and you see it in the Middle Ages, where actually the virgin's milk spills out and goes somewhere, and goes to feed people. It's the symbol of charity in the ancient Roman world.
So this is beyond just like the babies, you know, Jesus suckling at Mary's breast or
Horus
at Isis's
breast. Yeah,
this is something else.
And actually John Steinbeck used it at the beginning of one of his novels or the end of one of his novels, I think. The same idea of a woman helping somebody survive through nursing, grown.
Interesting.
Grown
I've
man.
Never heard
yeah.
that before. Well,
yeah.
well, now you also brought up some other interesting practices in the Viking film. You talk about Passamaquoddy practices of healing and burial.
Yeah.
What was that about?
Well, I was very lucky that I found a Passamaquoddy speaker. The Native Americans in this area spoke one of the languages that they spoke in Maine, particularly, is Passamaquoddy, and I was very fortunate to find a wonderful man who was a Passamaquoddy speaker, and he knew the old healing practices, and he knew the old burial practices, and so I was able to, because there's a death of a Passamaquoddy in my film, I was able to incorporate his knowledge about the practices of burial, and also the practice, and he knew also, because he was brought up by his two aged aunts, who also spoke, you know, they were born in the 19th century, so they continued speaking the ancient Passamaquoddy language, which is quite remarkable, and they, you know, through him, passed down the healing knowledge also, and so I was able to make a sort of medicine woman in that film based on what I learned, and it was just oral history from him. You know, it wasn't
mm-hmm.
like he ever wrote an article or something. It was just his own knowledge from his old, you know, from his aunts who brought him up.
Okay, so if you get the film, then you kind of see what the burial practices
yes,
and healing
yes.
practices are.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, I mean, it's not a documentary, you know. It's a fiction film, but you get glimpses of both of those things. You certainly get the burial, and you get glimpses of it. Mm-hmm.
And it's based on actual. It
yes.
isn't something, you know, you pulled out of the air. It's real.
Not at all. And plus, in the burial scene, there Roger Williams was a Catholic who left the Massachusetts colony and went and set up Providence, you know, in Rhode Island. And he became very close to the Native American Narragansetts in this area. That's a tribe that formerly lived in this area. And there are still some Narragansett Native Americans around. Also, I met some when I was doing research for this film. At any rate, he wrote a dictionary of the Native American language. And then he translated the dictionary. And the dictionary is like sayings. And at one point, in a dream sequence, I just lifted it from what Roger Williams had written down in the Narragansett, and I had it and I translated it. As a matter of fact, you will see that in Killian's Chronicle, the dialogue there's a whole portion where the Native Americans are actually speaking Passamaquoddy, and there's subtitling. I put in subtitling, so we put it actually into the authentic ancient language.
That's so cool.
With subtitles, because I didn't like the idea of Native Americans always sort of sounding dumb in Hollywood movies because
yeah.
they don't speak English well.
Right, right.
But they
right.
speak, you know, they speak their own language as well as we speak ours. So naturally, I wanted that to be conveyed, and so we conveyed it.
Well, that's great. Well, before we close tonight, I want to talk about your book, and it's called The Goddess Obscured. And I know we're going to sort of focus on one of the chapters, but why don't you just sort of give us a synopsis of the book itself?
Well, the ancient goddess who protected seeding and sowing the crop, sowing the seed into the ground, took a variety of names in the Mediterranean area. But she was a very powerful goddess. And in different areas of the Mediterranean, she was worshipped, particularly at the time when the seed was put into the ground. There were rituals that were practiced, particularly a ritual of taking her statue on a litter and walking around the field that had to be protected, that was just seeded, walking around the field with her statue. That was a very important ritual. Well, as Christianity began to make inroads into Europe, north, from Rome, and et cetera, as Paul came and whatever, and saints went out to Christianize over the centuries, they came upon evidence of this practice of the goddess on a litter or in some form being taken around the fields. Mm-hmm. And the church didn't want to accept the idea that this goddess had any power. So what they wanted to do was, as they did generally with other saints, they wanted to supplant a Christian saint for the goddess, or superimpose the Virgin Mary for the goddess. And this is what they did. We have texts which instruct the missionaries who went out, go to the place where the god or goddess is worshipped at the time when people worship the god or the goddess, and sprinkle the area with holy water, and rededicate the site to a new Christian saint. So, for instance, at one point, one of the missionaries was going out, and he saw a group of people taking the statue of the mother goddess, Berecynthia, this one's name was, around the field just after it had been sown. Well, the cart on which this goddess statue was got stuck in the mud, and he walked up and he said, "I rededicate this goddess, I rededicate this rite, and I transform this goddess in a way. I dedicate it to the Virgin Mary." And suddenly, the cart is unstuck.
So
they tell us. And everything is fine, and they take it around as the Virgin Mary. Now, of course, the people didn't, this is what the priest wrote later on. But it was a long time and many generations before this whole process, we call it a process of syncretism, took place, before the goddesses were supplanted in practice, in folklore, and in saints and hagiography with these varieties of female saints. And that's what my book is about. It's
about all the different different saints, goddesses that became saints.
Exactly. And through particular stories and through songs and through theater and through actual dance and through all these methods where in the imagination of the peasants, gradually they were able to accept the saints rather than the goddesses.
Well, it reminds me of the Yoruban deities ended up, how they're syncretized with the Catholic I think it's Catholic saints.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So sort of the same thing. Or even Artemis of Ephesus, how Mary, just gets the baton passed from Isis and Artemis to, and all of her name, all of the goddess names are now the epithets of Mary.
Exactly. That's exactly right. But of course, it's very rich and it's very different. The Yoruban, whether it's the Yorubans or whether it's in Mexico or wherever it is. I mean, these goddesses, the Virgin of Guadalupe. I mean, she's obviously an ancient. We know that she's some ancient goddess that was Native peoples there. They worshipped her, and then she becomes the Virgin, God of. I mean, that's people don't like to give up the sacred figures that they worship. They are afraid to, on the one hand, because you just don't desert, you don't desert an entity that you've been praying to that's been protecting you, that's been
might helping
be
divine
you.
Retribution in that.
There might be. Right.
Well, and also too, you know, if your prayers have been answered, you know, and, unless you're threatened with your life, then you know maybe you don't want to. It's you know
right.
it's you know it's really a situation where you're forced into it.
Right, right.
Well, Pamela, this has been extremely interesting, all of it. Is there anything I have forgotten to ask you that you wanted to share about any of your work? I mean, it's an incredible body of work you have here.
Well, thank you. I'm sure if you and I were sitting over a kitchen table having tea, we could talk for hours and hours, but that's not in the cards.
Yeah, especially if we had your book to go through and all of that, I could come up with a million questions for you. Anything else, or
Well, do you want to add, if anybody asks questions, I'd be happy to.
You know, actually, one of the people that was online, they hung up.
Oh, okay.
I didn't get to them fast enough, and I apologize if that listener out there is still listening. Okay, so we can get your, let's just recap. On Amazon, mm-hmm. we can get your three movies.
Yes, you can get the three movies.
So
one is Sorceress, mm-hmm. Which has my name attached somewhere on it, and a lovely image. It's both in English and in French with English subtitles. There's
okay.
Imported Bridegroom, and then there's Killian's Chronicle.
And that's the Viking one.
That's the Viking one, right, Killian's Chronicle. That's the Viking
okay.
and Native American one. And the book, I don't even know if it's in print, but they can certainly get it in the library, called The Goddess Obscured.
So what's your next project, Pamela? Are you taking a break,
well,
or are you working
no,
on something else?
No, I have another book, but the one that would be most interesting to your audience is I'm going to be doing some work on dreams, and dreams relating to medieval art in particular. But the book that I've just finished is something, I don't know if your audience is particularly interested in this, but it's the way the image of the Temple of Solomon was used. The image of the Dome of the Rock, really, was used as the Temple of Solomon in Christian, Muslim, and Jewish art through the centuries, from the 700s, right up through the 1920s. And
so
fascinating.
Does that
topic.
Involve any of like the imagery of Asherah or anything like that? Or
well, that's all
there?
Very interesting stuff. But I didn't go that far back to look at that. But I would be fascinated. Maybe I should do that at some point. thanks for the idea. I know that she was she's mentioned like I don't know 48 times or something in the Old Testament, and I know that in archaeology, some of the archaeology that's been discovered in the Holy Land. They do have these thrones of Yahweh and his consort
mm-hmm.
that were uncovered. So there was obviously a consort that was suppressed.
Right.
Even
conservative biblical scholars now cannot deny that God had a wife.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, and that the early Jews were really polytheists. You know, they're being dragged along, kicking and
yeah.
screaming. But
yeah.
you know, I think they're finally admitting it. So
well, they have to because Solomon. I mean, not only the Jews but the Christians. Solomon, who's like one of the major figures. What do you have? 1,000 wives, who all of whom. You know, worship, most of whom worship to these various and sundry gods in the high places, and he worshiped along with them. So there's a great hero who actually built that first temple, who was this polytheist, as you say, and and he's a Christian saint also. You see him in Chartres Cathedral in the stained glass windows. You've got Solomon right up there as a saint.
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. I think it's the north transept rose window at Chartres. I've got Solomon there. So,
very
you know,
cool.
And you've got him other places, too. You've got him in Chartres on the portals. And so he's a very important figure, like a you know saintly figure like David is and like Moses is in the Catholic Church. And this, you know, these people were, well, not Moses, but Solomon certainly was a polytheist. And generally, you know, that Old Testament, you hear about the high places and the trees and the springs and the, you know, the groves. All these are holy places, which, in fact, I've just written an article about this. remained holy places right through the 20th century and are at present, unfortunately, some of them are contended because they were Christian holy places, Muslim holy places, and Jewish holy places, and they're all battling for these holy places, some of which go back a couple of thousand years.
Yeah, probably started out as goddess holy places.
probably.
No yeah, doubt. I mean, I think if memory serves, I think there's this, even this place in Lebanon that people, it was sacred to Aphrodite, and people still worship Aphrodite there, supposedly.
Well,
you know, just
you
very
go.
Under mm-hmm. undercover, you know. Well, Pamela, thank you. Thank you very much. If anyone, you know, wanted to reach you personally, is there a website or?
No, I don't really have a website, but
okay.
I'm at Boston College. They could either they could email me at Boston College, I suppose.
Yeah, you have an email there at the.
Yeah, I do, you know, they can't expect an answer right away.
Yeah, because, well, you're on break right now anyway,
yeah,
right?
Break,
the school's
yeah.
out.
They could write me at Boston College. So that's how they can find me through my, there's a faculty page, if they write my name into Google or whatever. They come up Pamela Berger, Boston College. There'll be a way to reach me through that.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. You've been a delight, and I've learned so much from you tonight. I love when I learn new things, and you taught me a lot tonight, so thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a great pleasure to speak with you. Bye-bye.
Well, good night, and good luck on your next projects.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, listeners, as many of you know, adversaries of the sacred feminine try to sweep away awareness and knowledge of her for all time. And with that sweeping away, when the great she was made to disappear because of the religion of patriarchy, of selfish and disconnected men and their war gods, well, women and their power, their leadership, their spiritual authority, that was thwarted, repressed, became taboo, diminished, disrespected. That's why here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, I am dedicated to recovering the great she, whether she be deity, archetype, or ideal. Yes, we intend to defy, to taste the forbidden fruit, to be powerful and uppity women, to throw off the shackles, look under every rock, behind every locked door, peer into the abyss of the past so that we know why things are the way they are, how they have come to be so turned on their head and so unnatural. And we are going about setting things right. Why? Because if we want to save ourselves and the world, if we want to save the species on the planet, the very planet itself, I think we have no other choice. If we want to restore balance, harmony, wholeness, peace, sanity, it's women and our like-minded brothers armed with ideals of the sacred feminine who will set things back on course. So as the show comes to a close this evening, because Pamela was our only guest tonight, I will remind you of the two mottos of the show. The first is this. All truth passes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it is accepted for being self-evident. That's from the 19th century German philosopher, author Schopenhauer. And the second is attributed to Gandhi. First, they ignore you. Then they laugh at you. Then they fight you. Then they win. Well, that's how I see things happening with the sacred feminine. Eventually, we will win. So, I just want to remind listeners that airtime here on Blog Talk, well, no, it is not free anymore. I'm going to give you a free gift if you help support the show. If you can send in a contribution of any amount, I will send you some thank you gifts. If you can send in a contribution of $100, I will send you my 3D set of radio shows when I was on CBS discussing with other goddess advocates sacred places of goddess around the world. And there's no place else to get that but direct from me, because the archives no longer live on the internet over there at CBS. So please remember, even if it's if it's the first time you've heard it, the platform that we give our guests, it is not free of charge. It comes out of the pocket of hosts like myself. Think of goddess. Goddess teaches us what we nurture, what we nourish, what we tend to, well, it thrives. And what we neglect, it withers. And thanks to those of you who have already sent in donations, And I know I sound like a PBS fun drive, but unfortunately it is it's necessary. And I think you should know. So any donation of any amount is appreciated. And if you're listening to the show now and you're looking at your computer screen, look around my show page there and find the three F's. There's one for favorite, there's one for friend, and there's one for follow. Well, I'd love if you would mark the show a favorite and become our friend. I would love if you would put a comment about the show, because you can do that there. But maybe the most important of all of these buttons to press is the follow button, because if you click the follow button, you will never miss notice of my new guests each week, because sometimes I just get so busy I don't have time to send out email reminders, and that way you're a part of our growing family of listeners, and you're always on top of who's going to be on the show. And in case you don't know me that well yet, I also want to let you know, while I have a little bit of time here before the airtime expires, I do have two books myself, and you can find out more about them at my website, KarenTate.com. I invite the influx of new listeners from everywhere, because I know you're listening from not just here in Southern California, but literally across the globe. Please check out my two books, which have garnered prestigious endorsements and awards. Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations. I was mentioning that as I was talking to Pamela. That one has been endorsed by people in high places who I consider very learned and my mentors. And it's kind of an encyclopedia of goddess around the world. It teaches you about the sacred sites. It teaches you about the goddess. And if you're interested, it teaches you how to get there, whether you're an armchair tourist or one that actually has a passport and has the ability to go to these places on every continent. And then my second book, Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth, well, I describe that as sort of a spiritual, socio-political look at embracing goddess, deity archetype or ideal, into your life personally, or bringing her into your community. Both are sold everywhere, or you can take advantage of a special price I have for my listeners, which is listed there on my website. You can get both books plus for $25 plus shipping and handling, and one of them sells retail for $24, so you're practically getting two for one. So not a bad idea for yourself or for a loved one if you have an occasion coming up that you have to give a gift. And, you know, free stuff, I always like to mention the free stuff. When you're there at my website, KarenTate.com, on the Goddess Store page, don't forget to look at all the stuff there free. There are downloadable meditations that you can use. There's all sorts of interesting articles and references. So check that out. I've gotten good feedback. And one of the most recent articles I've had posted was run in an international magazine called La Luz International. And the article is titled, "The Inhumanity of the GOP, Always for Profits, Not People." And I do have a YouTube channel, and one of my more recent additions to the channel was a paper that I gave at the American Academy of Religion, and it talks about why the sacred feminine offers ideals for a sustainable future, and why the ideals of goddess are actually more in alignment with the ideals of Democrats. Very interesting. It talks about how we can achieve a sustainable world using secular law and goddess theology. So I invite you to listen and see what you think, and you know, if you have any comments, email me. So let me just mark the threshold that we're about to cross here as we come to the end of the show. I want to let you know that next Wednesday, I have returning to the show. He hasn't been here in about a year, but we have Frank Schaefer coming back. He's going to talk about his book, Sex, Mom, and God. And, you know, Frank is a former evangelical who has turned his back on that because he thinks it's insanity and craziness. And, you know, he has really been exposing a lot of the extremism extremist fundamentalism that's been coming out of the right wing by people, you know, who we call them, you know, dominionists, fundamentalists, extremists. So anyway, tune in and see what he has to say. You know, he was part of the early beginnings of the evangelical movement. He knows all the players, and he has lots of important information to share with listeners so that they understand, you know, what's really behind this. I know the last time he was on the show, he called the, you know, sort of the barbaric attitudes and the hate-mongering and the divisiveness, you know, he likened these people to people of the Bronze Age, you know, people who just had not evolved to this point where we see ourselves as interconnected, where we see, you know, see us having to, ourselves having to share, where we see our, you know, where we embrace diversity and religious tolerance. So I think you will enjoy him next week. So that being said, let me go ahead and shift gears a little bit here with you. We're going to do tonight's closing prayer. And I invite you to close your eyes and take a deep breath and sort of go within a bit, you know, connect in that place where you meet the divine, our mother, our sacred self. And I'd like to read for you something actually from St. Hildegard von Bingen. And these are her words, and it's from a book called Sister of Wisdom, St. Hildegard's Theology of the Feminine. And this is what Hildegard had to say. She is divine wisdom. She watches over all people and all things in heaven and on earth, being of such radiance and brightness that for the measureless splendor that shines in her, you cannot gaze on her face or her garment she wears. For she is awesome in terror as the thunder is lightning, and gentle in goodness as the sunshine. Hence, in her terror and her gentleness, she is incomprehensible to mortals because of the dread radiance of divinity in her face and the brightness that dwells in her as the robes of her beauty. She is like the sun, which none can contemplate in its blazing face or in the glorious garment of its rays. For she is with all and in all, and of beauty so great in her mystery that no one could know how sweetly she bears with people, and with what unfathomable mercy she spares them. And she certainly is sparing the humankind, isn't she, when you think about what devastation mankind is doing to the earth and to the peoples on the earth. And finally, it's just something here I got from the Goddess Temple in Orange County. They send me a short little prayer-like affirmation every month, and it says, Great Goddess, I am alive. I celebrate with all life under your midsummer sky. Thank you for my many blessings. Blessed be. Well, listeners, thank you so much for tuning in this week and every week. I appreciate knowing you're there. I encourage you to email me. Please, if you don't want to talk live on the show and ask your questions of our guests, you can always email me questions in advance. And you know what? I just like to hear that you're out there. I often take listener suggestions for guests and you know, topics for the show. So don't be shy. Make yourself known to me. So I am looking for a song to close the show with, and it's one by Abigail Spinner McBride. Let the Way Be Open. This is just a short version of it, but it's beautiful. So for the next minute, keep listening, and I promise you'll like it. This is Let the Way Be Open by Abigail Spinner McBride. Good night, listeners. Have a wonderful week, and I'll be with you next Wednesday.
Sing through my voice, play through my hands, let